Very surprised no one in this movie was named Bull Durham. I just kind of assumed that was his name.
Hi, and welcome to Episode of Cinema Nation. My name is Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Thomas Horton.
And I feel like the format's just completely thrown out the window right now in the middle of COVID-19. Like, our initial thing is to go through genre and to go through directors. And we were just kind of like, you know what? Let's just go through one movie. Our idea, I don't know if this will happen, our idea is to kind of, because we don't have sports right now, was to kind of look at sports movies for a bit. I don't know if we'll do it week by week. I mean, we kind of have time to do that right now, it feels like, but we will see. So we don't have sports right now. Baseball is about to start up. It didn't happen. I know Thomas is a big, would you classify yourself as a big baseball fan?
A big minor league fan.
Minor league baseball fan, okay.
I mean, it's kind of the same way I am. I love football, but I was not raised with any allegiances because South Carolina has no professional sports. But we did have a minor league baseball team, so that I have Charleston River Dogs till the day I die, baby. But
it's funny living in Los Angeles because people don't get that when I'm like, oh, who's your team? I was like, well, I don't really have a team. Like, outside of college football, because growing up in Alabama, you pick one of the you pick University of Alabama or Auburn. But they're just like, what do you mean you don't have a pro team? I was like, we didn't have a pro like Alabama has zero pro teams. The closest is like Atlanta. So a lot of people in Alabama love the Atlanta Braves or the Falcons. No one liked the Hawks.
Yeah, that is one thing about moving to Atlanta now is like I was raised on the Braves, not necessarily in my family, like my dad. I guess that's another part of my raising is my dad just kind of watches whoever he has like zero loyalties for any pro sports. But like the 90s, it was the Braves.
Braves.
90s baseball was the Braves, at least in the South. But I feel like most of the country at that point, they were the team.
Yeah, my grandfather used to watch a lot of Braves games, and I don't remember him being a big like baseball fan, but it was just like one thing he would put on and watch.
I mean, I guess there's something to be dug into there a little bit further if you want to do one of our like nerdy media episodes one day is, you know, the effect of in the 90s, a national television station being devoted to one team. I mean, you had WGN out there showing Chicago sports, but it wasn't as big as TBS was the Braves station. That's the whole reason it was created. So it was kind of like, a little bias was built in the country, I guess.
Atlanta changed everything. Ted Turner.
Was he
a part owner of the Braves? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Okay. He's not an owner anymore, correct?
I don't know. I mean, they don't play. They left Turner Field, but I don't know if he's still an owner.
Probably not, if I had to guess. Just like Disney no longer owns the Anaheim Angels or the Mighty Ducks. Hunter, one of our podcasters, was just recently watching the Mighty Ducks trilogy during this quarantine, and it's fun. I love that in one of the movies, in the third movie, there's literally a line where Joshua Jackson's flirting with a girl, and he's just like, he goes, "Oh, they named a pro team after us." Like that's their way of promote. It's such a weird. It's a very big tangent, but like it's just a weird like they're using a kids movie to promote hockey. And hockey team to promote the movie. It's just a very weird.
There's a lot of weird cross pollination of like 90s Disney. I mean, because you got the Angels, the Anaheim Angels too.
Anaheim Angels with Angels in the Outfield, which is a remake of like a 50s movie, I believe. Michael Eisner was the CEO at the time, and the weird stuff with the hockey thing is that I think he literally said, "Hey, my son really likes hockey. I want to like have more like time with my son. Let's buy a hockey team." That's what happened. He literally was just like, "I want to spend more time with my son," and he's not because he's getting older. He doesn't want to hang out with me. Let's buy a hockey team so he'll hang out with me.
I'd love to sit down with someone who understands, like the business side of entertainment a little bit more than I do. Like not just like the real like markets and all that stuff, because it's so funny reading the kind of entertainment history that I do about Disney.
Yeah.
And just reading everyone just shit on Michael Eisner. And I really want to talk to somebody who is completely objective about it and be like, was he a decent business person or not? Because from a creative point of view, he gets ragged on pretty hard.
Well, Eisner, this was not what I was expecting this show to go today. Because I read, there was a book called Disney War. Eisner was just kind of like, it's he was hot for a minute, and I think he did some very smart things. And what happened in the Disney, I could do a whole episode on this Disney culture stuff.
we'll count this as our call-in, as our voicemail for the...
Yeah,
for the...
as a voicemail question. Well, when Eisner first came in, in Disney in the mid 80s, some of the stuff that Eisner was given credit for was actually being done before he came in there. So things like Touchstone Pictures, which was like Disney trying to be more adult and release adult content. Their first one was Splash with Tom Hanks and directed by Ron Howard. That was the previous CEO that did that. What Eisner did was it was really him and his president, Frank Wells. And they were kind of the perfect kind of duo where people could go to either one of them. Frank Wells was the more like everyone's favorite person to go talk to. He was the more, I guess, like rational one. Like, and Eisner's the dad and he's the mom. Like they go back and forth. When, and Wells died tragically in a helicopter accident in the early 90s, I think around Lion King. And then basically Eisner said, hey, I'm going to take up both positions. What Eisner should have done was gotten a second in command, but he wouldn't do it. And that put so much stress, and that's when he started making a lot of bad decisions in the 90s, like trying to do a Disney like history theme park in Virginia when it was like Disney's America. And all that stuff.
Yeah, well, one of my, like, I wouldn't say guilty pleasures, but, you know, everyone has, like, that thing they put on when they're, like, cleaning the house or whatever. And that, for me, is, whatever. Like, Imagineering videos on YouTube. Like, these series that talk about how theme parks are built and that kind of stuff. I just find that all fascinating. And all from a theme park management viewpoint, everyone hates Michael Eisner.
Yeah, Eisner didn't do a great job of a lot of the parks that Eisner did, was commanding the building of, like, MGM Studios, even California Adventure. They weren't really that good when they first opened. It's like they had to I don't think California Adventure really picked up until a few years ago when they started adding a bunch of Pixar stuff. And now California Adventure has kind of become like the Pixar land.
Well, now they've got Marvel as well. So.
And they got Marvel. And so they're doing things like that. And then MGM Studios transferred to Hollywood Studios. And they've tried to kind of like add more Star Wars. That's now it has Galaxy's Edge. They're adding Star Wars stuff. So that's becoming like they're starting to just now, the past few years, rewrite the stuff that Eisner did. Because I guess what they're complaining about was that it felt like Eisner was just trying to make more money. So they just threw up these parks without much thought going into them. I think the only one that you could argue that they didn't do that with is Animal Kingdom. Animal Kingdom, I think, was... But I still, even then, they only had that many rides at first. Like, thrill rides. And that's what people were after. Yeah, Eisner's a very interesting guy. And I think what it was is just... It was a point when... people in the right to, I mean, Eisner, the thing is, you can't discredit Eisner, because Eisner was the one that picked Bob Iger to replace him, basically. Like, Iger was Eisner's right-hand person for a while. And so, and Iger's never really fully, Iger defends Eisner. He just did that in his memoir that he did, Ride of a Lifetime. He talks pretty highly of Eisner. Because he kind of is aware that Iger, he wouldn't be there if it was not for Iger or Eisner. Eisner and Iger, God.
I do I do love in the last season, it's one of the last couple episodes of BoJack Horseman. They're talking about, because in the 90s, the main character used to be in a sitcom on ABC. Mm-hmm. And they say something about, we've got these thoughts coming down from the network and BoJack goes, well, of course I'm going to listen to these thoughts because they're coming directly from Michael Eisner, and why would I question anything that Michael Eisner says? Which is great when you realize that Michael Eisner's production company makes BoJack Horseman.
He does, yeah. Yeah, he came to USC my first year there, and I went to like a Q&A with him, or like a Q&A thing with him, and he talked about, like, BoJack was his now big thing. Like, that was that was the biggest thing his company was doing at that time. So yeah, he just had, but the thing is, going with like complaining about Eisner, like, say, buying a hockey team because of his son. I mean, the thing is, executives have done such stupid stuff over the years. It's like Monster Trucks, that movie Paramount did, where it was like, it was an executive who did it because his kid wrote the story for it. It's like, hey, what if Monster Trucks were actually monsters? And his dad's like, that sounds great. Let's make that into a movie.
And then it was great.
I've never seen it either.
But it looked incredible. Thank you for answering my voicemail question about Michael Eisner.
I don't know if I did it well, because I don't want to go fully into the Disney like lore, because I don't know if I'll come out of it for an hour.
I just love I watch all these videos where they like interview Imagineers and stuff, and these people who are very deep in that part of Disney.
Yeah.
Speak about Michael Eisner as if he's like Darth Vader.
Yeah, a lot of people don't like him.
And it's you watch it and you're like, I mean, they had some financial troubles at that point, but he didn't like destroy the company. And the way that some people talk about him is like he did.
No, it's like Roy Disney, the son, Roy E. Disney, he kind of would run kind of like coups, basically. He did it in the 80s and that ousted the previous CEO who was Walt's son-in-law. And then he did the same thing with Eisner in the late 90s, early 2000s. But Eisner was just, I guess it's a point where like you've been there for so long, he kind of got power hungry and he was so worried about like the stocks and everything with Disney. And so that's when they bought ABC in the 90s. Like he laid some groundwork with what Disney currently is. But I think, the big thing is that he protected Disney from being bought out by Comcast. At one point, Comcast was trying to buy Disney. And if it wasn't for Eisner kind of coming in and like in the midst of him being at like a low point with Disney, he prevented that from happening. He also prevented at one point Disney was going to buy an AOL, and he said, let's not do that because it's going to bust. So he did some smart stuff for them, and because at one point it was Warner and Disney were going to go in together and buy AOL, I think is what it was. And so it was like all that stuff that's happening now with like Fox and Disney, all that was supposed to happen in the 90s. And Eisner kind of backed away from it. And the Comcast thing would have been huge. If Comcast bought Disney, that would have been a crate. So basically, they would be like what NBC is now and Universal. But Eisner was just like, no, this ain't happening. I'm not selling for any. We're not selling for anything. So yeah, there you go.
Nice. So if you saw Bo Durham in the episode title and clicked on it, we will be talking about Bo Durham now.
We'll transition that now. So we went from sports to Disney.
It was like a solid transition, man. Anaheim sports. We're talking
about... I'm glad. So today we're talking about Bo Durham,
which was not made by Disney.
Was not made by Disney. I believe it was. What was it? Who was it made by? Orion, I believe, is who it was. At that point, we talked about this in our early, our baseball episode we did a few months back earlier, this last year, during the World Series. And Bull Durham was a big component of the baseball boom of the 80s that led into the 90s. Before Bull Durham, besides The Natural, which came out in 84, 4 years before, there weren't really many baseball movies being made at that point. And writer-director Ron Shelton of Bull Durham, he tried to get this made, and no studio would want to do it. And then finally, Orion Pictures ended up making it, is what it was. So I have seen this movie before. Thomas had never seen this movie before. We have not talked about how he's felt about it. I do know his thoughts about a particular actor that's in this movie. So I kind of want to get into this now. Is Thomas, what were your thoughts on Bull Durham?
Kevin Costner works here.
Okay.
Here's my thing about Kevin Costner. Kevin Costner is an everyman, period.
Mm-hmm.
He is very charming here. I believe him here. We can talk about that a little bit more later. But he got a little bit after this, because this was his like he had Untouchables the year before this, right? And then
this was his like definitive role.
Yeah, I think this might have been the point. I'm not even sure I completely believe him in the Untouchables. He feels like a guy who lives in your town, who is just very charismatic. But he's definitely not Robin Hood. I don't think he's a guy who survives the apocalypse in either situation of apocalyptic movie he's in. I very rarely buy him outside of present day and doing anything other than being a normal person.
Okay.
But he's very, very good at being a normal person.
Okay. Okay.
If that makes sense.
No, it does. It does.
We had this conversation over text last week when I watched Mosquito Coast, because Harrison Ford kind of treads that line too. And
yeah.
And yeah, you buy him in a lot more genres than you do Kevin Costner, but he's an everyman, and sometimes that can affect what roles you can play.
Yeah.
And I think everyone saw how charming Kevin Costner was in some movies that he was very well cast in, and then thought, I can put myself in anything now. And then we just got Kevin Costner oversaturation, and Robin Hood was the death of it. God, that movie's awful.
I don't know if Robin Hood's the death. I think you could argue Waterworld was probably the death of that with Costner. Even though I love Waterworld, I'm just going to be real. I defend that movie.
When he's standing there with like the hair and the tan on the raft, I'm like, no, dude, you're Kevin Costner from middle of nowhere America.
You're from Iowa, damn it. Yeah,
you should be out farming or something. Like, you would be dead in the apocalypse. Like, there's nothing that special about you.
Yeah, I don't think Costner maybe is the best choice for Waterworld. Even though the movie is great. Waterworld is like a Mad Max on water. So you need like a Mel Gibson, Tom Hardy.
There's just something about him that feels so grounded, and it works really well in this. It works really well in Field of Dreams to like rein in the movie that gets a little ridiculous at times. He's incredibly well grounded, but sometimes that is to his detriment, I think, when you're trying to do something genre.
So you liked Kevin Costner in this.
I liked him as Crash. This might be the role I've liked him the most in, I think.
Now, what are your overall... Okay, so
very surprised. Got to start this off by saying, very surprised no one in this movie was named Bull Durham. I just kind of assumed that was his name in this movie.
No, because it's named after the Durham Bulls.
Yeah, well, then why would you call it Bull Durham?
I know. I was thinking about,
call
like...
it Durham Bulls.
I was thinking about, was it always called Bull Durham? For one, the movie was originally called Player to Be Named Later. That was the original title for the movie. But I honestly thought, I was like, did they pick Bull Durham because they were able to shoot in Durham, North Carolina? Like, if they didn't, like, would it be like Biscuit or Biscuit Montgomery would be the name if they were shooting Montgomery?
Tourist Asheville?
Yeah, like, it was the name, like, that hinge on where they shot at. Is what I'm wondering.
Yeah, it works. It flows off the tongue really well. Yeah, but like it definitely flows off the tongue better than Durham Bull. But yeah, it's a weird title. It doesn't really make sense.
But forget that. So,
but yeah, no. When he showed up and his name was Crash Davis, I was like, wait, I thought he was Bull Durham.
And he's playing for the Durham Bulls. That makes sense, right? So first off, for those that haven't seen Bull Durham, because we skipped this, the premise of Bull Durham. It stars Kevin Costner as Crash Davis, Tim Robbins as Nuke. I'm blanking on his last name.
Lelouch.
That's what it was. God, how do you forget that? His name's Nuke. Nuke Lelouch. And then you have Susan Sarandon as Annie Savoy. So basically, Tim Robbins is this like hotshot pitcher who comes up and he's in single-A baseball, in minor league baseball, because there's three divisions of minor league baseball. He's the bottom division, and apparently the team that is like kind of invested in him has spent like $1 million to invest in this kid, and they need some older veteran to come in and help teach Nuke how to play baseball. And that's when they bring in Kevin Costner, Crash Davis, who is being demoted from AAA baseball to single-A baseball to help mentor this kid. As this is happening, Susan Sarandon as Annie, every year in Durham, she essentially takes a young player under her wing to teach him the game of baseball and the game of life. And they're going to be lovers for that season. And it's like she is really like kind of a scout, basically, where she's there to help the player kind of learn the game. And so it creates this weird triangle between Costner, Sarandon, and Robbins, where it's both a love triangle, because Saranen ends up picking, or Annie ends up picking Nuke over Crash, because Crash takes himself out of the equation. It's a love triangle, but also a mentor triangle, where they're like trying to get to Nuke and how, and try to teach him how to become a better baseball player.
Yeah, I was reading one of the articles we were looking at to prep. I like kind of called it, it's a love triangle, but it's also like a mentorship.
Yeah, it is.
Triangle. There's a love triangle where both of the men are kind of competing for Susan Sarandon, but then there's a mentorship triangle where Susan Sarandon and Kevin Costner are competing for Tim Robbins.
I actually forgot how the love triangle is a part of the movie, but I thought it was much bigger in the movie.
Yeah.
And it actually isn't.
I thought it was going to be too, yeah. But it's
actually
not.
More of the mentor triangle.
Mm-hmm.
Because Costner and Sarandon don't have a lot of scenes together. Like, they kind of have it at the beginning of the movie and then the end of the movie, but not much in between.
Yeah, and it kind of sticks to the rules it creates. Like, he goes over, so she has this scene where she's like, I'm going to pick between the two of you, and he says, I've been playing minor leagues for 12 years, I'm going to try out, and takes himself out, and then later kind of comes back to her, and she says, oh, I already picked Lelouch and I only pick one player a season, and then it's just kind of, they just kind of leave it at that. They have some like flirtation, but there's this understanding that she is very set in her rules, and she is with Abby for the rest of the season.
Layla, where are you going?
After 12 years in the minor leagues, I don't try out. Besides, I don't believe in quantum physics when it comes to matters of the heart.
What do you believe in then?
Well, I believe in the soul. The cock, the pussy, the small of a woman's back, the hanging curveball, high fiber, good scotch, that the novels of Susan Sontag are self-indulgent, overrated crap. I believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. I believe there ought to be a constitutional amendment outlawing AstroTurf and the designated hitter. I believe in the sweet spot, softcore pornography, opening your presents Christmas morning rather than Christmas Eve, and I believe in long, slow, deep, soft, wet kisses that last 3 days. Good night.
Oh, my. Crash?
Hey, Annie, what's all this molecule stuff?
Crash? Crash, wait. Look, all I want is a date. I'm not going to fall in love with you and miss him.
I'm not interested in the woman who's interested in that boy. Good night.
Well, I'm not interested yet.
Who are you calling a boy?
See you at the yard, me.
Damn, nobody's ever said no to a date with me before.
He's crazy. I want you bad.
Yeah, it's wild to watch this movie in the with the social context, knowing that Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon were together for like 20 years after they made this movie. Because this chemistry between her and Kevin Costner feels so much stronger in this movie.
Very much so.
Which, I mean, it's designed to, you know, you're supposed to the whole time believe that Crash is her emotional and intellectual equal, while she's probably a little too mature for Nuke.
Their scene at the batting cage, mm-hmm. I think it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Yeah, that was great. I really enjoyed that scene
because it has such a Preston Sturgis, like early screwball comedy type vibe to it, where they're talking about baseball, but also really kind of talking about sex, and you learn so much about, I think, both characters in that scene. Especially Costner's Crash, where she brings up like, oh, I did the stats on you. You're like 15 or 20 home runs away from holding the minor league record. And she's like, oh, they should write about that. He's like, no, it's basically saying like, if you're saying you're the best in the minor leagues, that means you never made it in the majors.
You're pulling your hips.
I know, but they're nice hips. I looked up your records.
You what?
Mm-hmm. You hit 227 home runs in the minors. That's not bad.
Don't tell anybody.
Why not? You hit 20 more this year, you're going to be the all-time minor league champ. The record's 246.
Well, 247 home runs in the minor leagues would be a kind of dubious honor.
I think it would be great. The sport news should know about it.
No, just no. Please.
Okay.
Last chance. Your place or mine.
Despite my rejection of most Judeo-Christian ethics, I am, within the framework of the baseball season, monogamous.
Give me a break.
It's true.
Stop it. Jeez, the fact is you're afraid of meeting a guy like me because it might be real. So you sabotage it with some, what is it, bullshit about commitment to a young boy you can boss around? That's a great deal.
Nice.
I know women like you. Ooh, I know women like you. You're a regular patron saint, you know? Stray cats, lost causes, or 6'3" homeless studs.
Oh, Crash, you do make speeches.
And I've heard this said before, Ron Shelton talk about this with the character Crash, is that he's a character who loves something more than it loves him.
Mm-hmm.
Is that he loves baseball so much, but baseball's never fully loved him the way he loves it.
There's a great line, I don't remember exactly what it is, but when he and Nuke are like getting in each other's faces, and Nuke says, why do you hate me so much or something, and Crash has a line where he says, you've got talent, but you don't love the game. I love the game, and I don't have what you have.
Yeah, and that's the whole bit towards the end. We're skipping ahead a little bit in the movie, but when Nuke tells Crash he's being called up to the majors, and it's kind of just a like, great, here goes another one that's getting a spot that I wished I had. And also, too, I think he knows in that moment when Nuke's getting called up, he's on now borrowed time. Mm-hmm. He's not gonna, his whole goal was to get Nuke ready for the majors. And now that Nuke's gone, why do they need Crash?
Yeah, there's a really fun smaller arc though where they don't lean into it too hard. But when Crash first at bat with the Bulls, he's not great, and you have this whole inner monologue with him. And even though the movie is focused on Nuke's progression in the sport, you also see Crash getting better, and you realize it's all in his head because he's obviously a great player, but he was just kind of burned out, and you see him kind of refinding the game through Annie.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, by the end of the season, like there's Nuke, but then Crash is also kind of like the star player for them now. There is like a little bit of hope in you as in the audience when Nuke leaves. You're like, they can't get rid of Crash. Like, everybody loves Crash. But you have to remember that he was there only as a mentor role for Nuke. That was the only reason they brought him in.
I think it's up there as one of the best baseball movies. Because I think it really captures the realism of baseball.
Yeah. I love one of the interviews with Ron Shelton was he said anytime he read these like big essays about the mythology of baseball, anything like The Natural, that's like these are Greek gods.
Yeah.
He was like, that's not the baseball I played. And I think this movie treads a really fine line of being there's all these little idiosyncrasies and there's all these little ridiculous character traits, but it still feels like it's set in the real world.
Yeah.
Whereas something like Major Leagues is, you watch it and you go, this is a comedy. This would never happen. No one would let this happen to a pro team. Yeah. And I think that's part of the charm of minor league baseball, is it's so weird and out there that you can believe that this would happen in this, you know, that all these players. I love the little thing where Annie just sets up at a game and she's just got bat boys taking notes to the players the whole game about their form. Like that's amazing.
Well, and it also has these weird things of like the weird events they have at minor league baseball things. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we have all the kids here. We're going to drop $1,000 and the kids just run around and try to grab the money.
I think I told this story on the, when we were doing the baseball podcast about the Yelp day they had at the Charleston River Dogs.
Maybe. I'm not positive.
Okay.
Though.
Well, listeners, if you listen to that episode and this episode too, great. The Charleston River Dogs had this. Part of the reason I love minor league baseball is it's just a feat of marketing.
Yeah.
You can do whatever you want in minor league baseball if you think it's going to bring some people in and you can just go for it.
Yeah.
They did a game where this woman had written a review on Yelp and given the stadium like one star, and it was like, haven't been to a game here,
but I drive by
it on my way to work and I don't like the stadium or something. And they said the first three innings, they were like, we want to cater directly to you and give you a 5-star experience. So the first three innings, the park will be shut to everyone except for this one woman. and she didn't show up, but they said the gates, by the time they opened it up after the third inning, the gates were like packed with people who wanted to just come in and say they'd been at that game.
Or then, like, because this night even had, like, the wedding where a player marries one of the big fans that's kind of Annie's right-hand woman, basically.
Well, and I love the scene where the kind of first scene where Crash and Nuke are butting heads, and where Nuke, like, shrugs off Crash's pitch call.
Yeah.
And it's like, I want to throw it fast. And
to announce my presence.
So Crash tells the batter that he's going to throw a fastball. But I love they're having this argument. Meanwhile, like, you can hear the announcer because the guy hit a home run and hit this, like, cutout of a bull. and the bull is, like, shooting out steam. And the announcer's going, go down to so-and-so restaurant and get a free steak.
Yeah, it definitely has a good, like, atmosphere quality. Like, you're always hearing the announcement, even though it has nothing to do with the scene. You're hearing kind of the crowd and everything. It's very, like, it's very detailed.
But you could not, there's a certain level of nobody cares that the minor leagues hit on. Anything goes. Nobody really cares that much, except for the people who do care. Like, there's like a couple of people in that town that love that team. And that it's a really weird atmosphere that I don't think really exists in, like, any other type of sport. Like, no other real, I mean, there's some other minor league stuff out there, but, like, and I have a friend who worked in marketing for a minor league hockey team, and you know, they do some fun stuff, but I don't think anything is, like, as weird and unique as minor league baseball.
So we're jumping ahead around with this, but the background of this film, I think, to touch on why it's so realistic, is because Ron Shelton was a minor league baseball player, went a couple of years and decided to stop doing baseball. I think he fell out of love with it, and that's kind of his thing, was that he didn't want to become a Crash Davis who kept going not knowing when to actually end it. And so he quit baseball, went to school, and got a master's degree in like in art, and he started doing performance art type stuff, and then realized he hated that and wanted to do more of, like, film related things. And so he started writing screenplays, and I think he wrote for Under Fire, which was a Gene Hackman, Nick Nolte movie. And then he got to a point where he gained enough traction where he wanted to direct a movie, and that's when he wrote Bull Durham. He was like, if there's one movie that I can write about that no one else can write about, it's about minor league baseball, because I know that world, and no one's going to direct it better than I can. And so this was kind of his, like, one shot at doing it. And he ended up becoming, like, a director who mainly focused in the sports genre. He did White Men Can't Jump as well. I think he did Tin Cup with Kevin Costner.
Yeah. Tin Cup's fine.
You don't like Tin Cup, but that's exactly how you described what Kevin Costner should be.
And Kevin Costner's good in Tin Cup, and he has great form for a golf movie. Just not a, I don't know. I've seen it a couple times. It's one of those, like, you see it on television, I'll watch a couple scenes, but I'm not, I still don't know that we've, other than Caddyshack, I don't know that the world's been given the great golf movie yet. I don't think it's Bagger Vance.
It's no Happy Gilmore or Greatest Game Ever Played.
It's not Happy Gilmore. It's not that Shia LaBeouf. I saw that Shia LaBeouf one at some point. It's not Jim Caviezel in Bobby Jones' Stroke of Genius, which I bet you didn't even know existed.
I think I heard about that. It's not 7 Days in Utopia with Lucas Black and Robert Duvall. Don't watch that movie. Don't watch that one. Don't do it. Just don't do it. So Ron Shelton, he ends up doing Bull Durham. So some weird casting choices. This is towards the end of the show, but I'm gonna put this up before. Weird casting choices for this. It sat around for a bit. The big one, Kurt Russell was supposed to play Crash Davis originally. Kurt Russell was actually a minor league baseball player as well, and he helped Shelton develop the script.
Was he really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. You know, his son played hockey.
Oh, really? Wyatt did?
Yeah, Wyatt was a hockey player for a long time.
So basically, Kurt Russell was a... That's what I read, at least. Kurt Russell played in the minors for a little bit.
Look at that. Wyatt really just following the family footsteps. minor league pro player turned actor.
He was a switch-hitting second baseman for the California Angels minor league team in the 70s. And then was forced to retire in 73, and that's when he returned to acting.
Yeah, that's wild, because he was really famous at that point anyway.
Yeah. And his father was also a professional baseball player. Bing Crazy. Russell.
What a family.
He ended up owning a Class A minor league baseball team. Kurt Russell's dad.
The Anaheim Angels, which brings us back to Michael Hudson.
So Kurt Russell helped develop the project. He was penciled in, but didn't work. But I read that after the movie was over, he wrote like fan mail to Costner and Shelton because of how much he loved the movie. So that was Crash. Also up for Crash, Nick Nolte was allegedly offered the role of Crash and turned it down because he didn't like baseball.
That wouldn't have been good.
Another rumor was that allegedly, I use allegedly with this, Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd were offered the roles of Crash and Annie, but had to turn it down because of Moonlighting, their series.
They were like already doing Moonlighting at that point?
They're already doing Moonlight at that point. I guess it was Moonlighting in an 89, this came out in 88, so they were towards the end of it. But I think also it might have been, I think Bruce Willis ended up doing Die Hard, so it's okay. But that was the original idea of them playing Crash and Annie. Other what ifs with these characters, Nuke. Three people who were up for Nuke. The one big one, Anthony Michael Hall, was originally supposed to play Nuke. The studio wanted him to be cast, but Shelton said no, he wanted to cast Tim Robbins. And he, pun intended, went to bat for Tim Robbins, and that's how Robbins got the role. Also apparently up for it, David Duchovny and Charlie Sheen, who instead did Eight Men Out, another baseball movie that came out in 88. The long list of rumored people for Annie, they either were offered it, or they auditioned for it, or they were talked about. Cybill Shepherd is one. Carrie Fisher, Deborah Winger, who allegedly turned it down. Michelle Pfeiffer auditioned, but they said was too young. Glenn Close, Kim Basinger, Mary Stenbergen, Gina Davis, and Kate Capshaw.
Wow.
Were all rumored or auditioned for the role of Annie. And Susan Sarandon is the one that got the role.
She nailed it. Let me tell you something real quick about Tim Robbins in this role. There's two actors who played dumb so convincingly that my parents, anytime they're describing that person, they'll say, "Oh, that dumb guy from blank." And my and Tim Robbins for my entire life was that dumb guy from Bull Durham. My mom saw him in Bull Durham and really disliked him ever since, I think. Because he was so dumb and my dad is that way with Bill Paxton from True Lies. He's just always like, oh, that dumb guy from True Lies.
You mean that great dumb guy from True Lies? No, my mom's always felt that way about Bradley Cooper because she remembers him from Wedding Crashers as like the a-hole boyfriend of Rachel McAdams. So she always like sees him as that until I think A Star Is Born flipped her.
Well, that's the thing is, like, I think it's a little more understandable to, like, remember a villain and be like, oh, like,
yeah,
like, Alan Rickman's always going to be Hans Gruber. Like, there's some people out there, like, Alan Rickman's always going to be a bad guy because of Hans Gruber. But just to remember someone as being dumb really shows you how well he played Nuke here.
And it was his breakout role. Mm-hmm. But what were some other big scenes that popped out at you that you liked?
I love that scene. We played it as a clip in the baseball episode, but I love the scene when they're having the huddle at the pitcher's mound.
Yeah,
and they're just all talking about all the crazy stuff that's going on, and Robert Wohl comes running. Didn't know Robert Wohl was in this.
He's great. I met him at
USC one time.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, he came to try out his next stand up set. And did like only like five people showed up. It was interesting experience. He was like sick, going up to us individually after every joke and being like, "What did you think of that joke?" But no, everyone was really fun in this. Tim Taylor's brother from Home Improvement as Jimmy, the Christian baseball player.
Okay,
that guy was Tim's brother on Home Improvement. I don't know if anybody else.
You're right.
I don't know if anybody else owned DVDs of Home Improvement like I did, but I was a big Home Improvement kid. I love that scene. I love them out on the road, especially when they're doing well. I like seeing the friendship form between Crash and Nuke because the whole like we were talking about, the whole mentorship triangle is played really well.
It is
where you kind of see that you know, initially you've got Annie's hold over Nuke, and then you start to see him actually start listening to Crash, and kind of see him trying to like balance both of their advice out. Yeah, man, it was fun. It's really fun.
No, but the scene you were talking about is when it goes to the mound, and it's the when they're just like, we're trying to figure out what to get Annie or what to get Maggie and this guy for their
wedding present.
For their wedding.
And then the other guy's like, I need a chicken. So I need to sacrifice a chicken to get the curse off of my back.
This guy's dad or Nuke's dad's here.
Yeah.
Like but what I love about that scene is just the awkwardness of the crowd. They're just like,
yeah. And then Robert Wool runs up and he's like, what's going on up here? And they list off all the stuff. And he's like, okay, yeah, yeah, no, that makes sense.
What's wrong?
I'm a little nervous. My old man's here.
Your dad's here? Where's he at?
He's right by the home plate. Don't look. Don't look.
Look, he's waving. Hey, he's just your old man. He's as full of shit as anybody.
Hey, what's going on?
Breathing through the wrong fucking eyelid again, Nuke.
Shut up.
Hey, did you guys hear about Jimmy and Millie?
Yep.
They got engaged. Can you believe that?
Oh, yeah? Well, wait till I tell him she's gone down on half the Carolina League.
Hey, anybody says anything bad about Millie, I break his neck.
Excuse me.
Guys, I got a game to pitch here.
Hey, you guys, don't throw me anything. My girlfriend put a curse on my glove.
I'll take the hex off the fucking glove. Give me the glove.
Well, then you gotta cut the head off a live rooster.
What the hell's going on out there?
Looks like a convention. Pretty soon they're gonna call the roll.
Get your ass out there and check it out.
But.
Excuse me, what the hell's going on out here?
Well, Nuke's scared because his eyelids are jammed and his old man's here. We need a live rooster? We need a live rooster to take the curse off Jose's glove, and nobody seems to know what to get Millie or Jimmy for their wedding present. Is that about right?
That's right.
We're dealing with a lot of shit.
Okay, well, candlesticks always make a nice gift, and maybe you can find out where she's registered, maybe a place setting or maybe a silverware pattern. Okay, let's get to it. Here we go.
He was hot for a minute. I mean, Robert Wool with that and Batman in 89.
Robert Wool, a lot of people forget this. Robert Wool single-handedly created HBO television. I'm pretty sure Arliss was their first, like, scripted.
It might have been.
Arliss was, like, the first big scripted HBO show.
1996. So. That went on for 7 seasons? Man. Let's see, what's it? The show, which has been referred to as an example of how premium cable networks take a different approach to managing their programming. Oh, wow. Arliss was cited by a number of HBO subscribers as the sole reason that they paid for the network.
Yeah, I remember him talking. I saw him talking one time where he was like, yeah, you know, like Sports Night was on, like, you didn't have to be on premium cable, but like, we were also just kind of making it more realistic that like when sports reporters go into the locker room afterwards, most of the players are naked and we can actually show that. Like, yeah. That was just some of, like, and it was groundbreaking at that point.
So apparently, I'm reading, because I never saw Arliss, but I remember Arliss being a thing. Entertainment Weekly repeatedly referred to it as one of the worst shows on television. And sports writer Bill Simmons used Arliss as an example of what he saw as a lack of quality fictional shows about sports.
Oh, Bill, I'm not going to bat for Arliss. I've seen some episodes, but I do think it's historic. Like it kind of set the tone for what an HBO show could be. Like, there's going to be nudity, there's going to be profanity. Like, it's not like normal television.
But no, yeah, he was. So yeah, Robert Wool was in Bull Durham and Batman. Was in Bodyguard. Was in a couple. Was in Blue Chips for a little bit. Was in Cobb, which is also a Ron Shelton movie. Yeah, didn't do much post 90s. Anyway, but he's great in that scene. I think he's a good he. The thing about this movie too, there's not a lot of big standout roles in support. There's not a lot of big names in the supporting roles, except maybe Wool and the manager, who's played by Trey Wilson, who was also in Raising Arizona. I hate that. That's one drawback. Not maybe that's a drawback, but I do feel like we don't get. I don't know if this film is missing more supporting characters, if that makes sense.
I would have liked a little more like humorous color to the team. Like I really enjoyed Jimmy, like the super Christian guy,
yeah,
who kind of stuck out like a sore thumb, and the guy that like believes in voodoo and everything is fun. Like I would have liked a little bit more of that. Just kind of show us like a little bit more of the kind of oddities on the team, that sort of thing.
And you have one guy who gets cut, and you're just kind of like, well, I don't really know him, so I don't really feel anything of why he's getting cut. It's there to set up when Crash gets cut later. I think that's all that scene is there for. So this film ended up becoming like a minor box office success, made about $50 million at the box office on like a low, like $5 million budget, I think is what it was. Let me see. $7.5 million budget. It was, I think, Costner's definitive role. I think breakout roles for Tim Robbins, maybe Susan Sarandon. I think pre this, she was in films, but not as a big star. But this one kind of lifted her up to like A-list status, it feels like. Without Bull Durham, I don't think you can get Thelma and Louise for her. But yeah, so became successful. I think it ended up kind of inspiring the baseball boom, because when Shelton was trying to pitch the movie around, no one would make it because baseball movies weren't a thing. Like, they didn't see it as a viable option. And I think once Bull Durham happened, that's when you start seeing things like Major League, Field of Dreams, Sandlot, League of Their Own. It became a pretty... It kind of helped create a subgenre. Even though there were examples of this before, I think it showed that you can make a baseball movie that didn't have to be a biopic.
Yeah, you could have some fun with it. Like, it didn't have to be Pride of the Yankees kind of thing.
Yeah, it had to be Pride of the Yankees. It didn't even have to be The Natural. It could be kind of a hard-edged movie. So, awards for the films. Not awards, but let's just kind of things to talk about. What needed work? We talked about we wanted more characters, more kind of development of the supporting characters. What else needed work?
I mean, I think that's kind of my thing. I really enjoyed how much like minor league quirk it worked into it, but I would have liked more. I would have liked, you know, more people in like Annie's little posse. She had Millie? You said Millie. Maggie earlier. Millie.
You're right, it's Millie.
She had Millie, who was kind of like another groupie, but you know, I would have liked seeing some more fans, like seeing some more people in the town that enjoyed it or that sort of thing. Because I do think all the supporting characters that are there work really well. Like you said, like the manager and all are all really well done. So that would have been the only thing I would ask for. I think this captures the spirit of the minor league really well. And in seeing that, I would have liked to see it go a step further.
My one thing in this rewatch that I'm not stealing from Bill Simmons when I say rewatch. The one thing I noticed that didn't really hit for me was actually the ending. It felt like... So the thing is, you've been building towards Kevin Costner and Susan Sarandon finally getting together. And what didn't really work for me is that it kind of has two endings. They get together. You kind of have this fun, like, essentially sex montage between these two that goes on for, like, days.
Mm-hmm.
And you could probably end the film. They're like, they've gotten together. It's moving. He's been cut, but he's going to figure out what to do. But then it kind of takes a little bit of a left turn, and he just leaves her and goes off to play in Asheville. And then she kind of narrates a little bit of a section where Tim Robbins is off, kind of like, he's off in the majors. Costner's off. He got the home run record. And then he comes back, and they have, like, they're sitting on the porch moment of, oh, I'm going to go try to get a job here. Do you want to go with me? It almost feels like it had to pick either like one of the two endings, either the full, like the fun sex montage, or they have some sort of moment. He leaves and then comes back to her. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think what they're going for there, I think, is, you know, there's throughout the whole movie, there's Newt getting pulled back and forth between Annie's philosophy of baseball and Crash's philosophy of baseball, but there's also Crash. There's all these different triangles, and you've also got this triangle that's Crash in the middle, and Nuke on one side, who is all about the career, and Annie on the other side, who is about the game and for the love of the game.
Yeah,
and I think what that's supposed, because the whole time Crash kind of views that record as a failure.
Yeah,
because it shows that he's never gonna be anything better than, you know, the best player in the lowest league. And I think what him going back for it symbolizes is that she's finally won him over. It's about the love of the game and because of that, he does need to set this record. It's one last goal left in the game and not in the career.
Okay.
And I think that's kind of what it symbolizes, is she's won out in that he's got to see it through for the love of the game, and not necessarily for his like legacy or his career or anything, but just according to her philosophy.
I agree with that. I guess it was just the
it's sex... not, it's not executed very well.
Yeah. I the sex montage is so not over the top, but it's just very lighthearted, I guess you could say. Like, it's very charming and kind of comedic.
Mm-hmm.
Where it just feels like you're on such a high, and then we just kind of take a little bit of a left, like we take a little bit of the exit ramp for one more stop, and then come back to this.
Yeah, I love that scene on the porch, though.
The scene on the porch fantastic. Is great.
He's just like, I'm tired of talking about baseball. Can we talk about something else? And yeah. she's like crying a little bit, and she's like, I can try.
No, I think I really like that scene. I wondered if it would have had a bigger impact if you didn't have that comedic kind of like. If the thing is, I'm fine with it. It almost feels like it needed to happen earlier in the movie. Does that make sense? It feels like we're rushing to the finish line pretty quickly. We're like, their whole big kind of moment where they finally get together is the last like 10 minutes of the movie, and then it goes off to a separate thing real quick. Yeah,
in execution, it does feel rushed, especially having it all done by voiceover.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's kind of the idea, is like if he was really truly bitter over Nuke moving up and him not, he would have just given up there and would have rather not have set that record.
Yeah.
But she has to show him that it's not about, you know, the game is bigger than his own career, and having that record is actually worth something to him.
Okay.
There you go.
I agree with that part. It's just the execution.
Yeah. It's not pulled off the best, but what they're going for, I think, is it's worth leaving in.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. We've kind of talked about some stuff. What really worked about this movie?
I think all the main characters worked. All the performances. We'll get into performances a little bit more later, I've used the word idiosyncrasies more, I think, in this episode than I've said the word idiosyncrasy in a while. But they're all these weird little characters with quirks and tics, and everybody sells them all really well. The whole cast, like I said, the supporting characters, and as I've said before, I think the atmosphere as well. This is minor league baseball is the only place this story could have happened.
Yeah, I think that all worked. I think we'll talk about performance, but I think Crash, I think Costner, that when you watch this, you can see why Costner became Costner. I'm not saying he became like, because I know you have feelings about him in later films, but I feel like you could see why he was so likable in this movie, or for later. Least realistic player,
Tim Robbins, 100%. Which I mean, they play off like he's got, they keep saying he's got a powerful pitch, but it's all over the place, so that makes sense that his form is awful, but it's really bad, and he has really poor form. I don't even know form that well.
Yeah, I watched it. I was like, oh yeah, this is pretty bad. I think it was one of the articles, maybe it was a separate thing that I read somewhere, but it was talking to like one of the guys who trained them. They're like, oh yeah, Costner's great, he could do this, and they go, Tim Robbins, he needed a little bit of work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was very much just like, we did what we could with him. Like, even when, like, yeah, his pitching just feels weird, where, like, the ball's going behind his back at some point when he's throwing. It just feels, thing he's doing, he's not looking when he's throwing, because that's the whole, like, anything that she tells him.
Yeah, there's also a scene when at the batting cages, when Annie takes a swing at one and is trying to show Crash the right form or something, and she's like, do you see my hips? And he says, yeah, and it's supposed to be flirty, but it's not a very good swing that she takes. I'm not saying, like, Susan Sarandon, like, Annie doesn't know baseball. I think she knows everyone's form, and she would be a great coach, but
yeah,
I don't know that it was the right call. Like, from a flirty point of view, it's great to put her out there, but, like, I don't think... Yeah. She nailed the like physicality of it in a way that was like, okay, maybe she should just give people notes. Like, maybe she should have just been like standing behind Costner and like adjusting his hips as opposed to like showing him how to do it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then most realistic player,
it's Crash. Costner nailed it. I mean, that's like, he's well known for Tin Cup and like doing a lot of work to get his golf swing down too. It's wild watching how many sports movies there are where the actors just
don't play sports.
Look like they can play sports whatsoever.
It's like the way he even just rounds first felt realistic. If you, because I noticed that we're like, he's not running straight at the back. He's kind of running at a little bit of an angle so he can run to second. Like, he very much knows how to play the game. And then they said that he hit home runs while playing.
While like, shooting? Oh, that's shooting, awesome.
Where he actually hit home runs. He hit two home runs while on camera. And the, I never really, I don't remember a scene where I saw it. Maybe it was in a montage where he like wanted to throw people out at second, and he would throw people out at second during the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his, I think his stance is pretty realistic. I think his catching stance is realistic. But yeah, I think he was the most realistic player.
Oh,
again,
oh, I gotta go back real quick. Scenes I really liked. When he's arguing with the umpire.
Oh, yeah.
And they're just, like, bumping chests with each other. And then, like, everyone's watching. But then as soon as they're like, you're out of here, the manager's, like, out there, like, doing the exact same thing. Everyone's just bumping chests with each other. It's amazing.
Now, and then going back to another thing I liked, and we mentioned it a little bit, was that with the talking back and forth when Tim Robbins is waving Costner off. He's like, no, I'm going to throw the heat. And then he does it the second time where it's just like, dude, you learned your lesson the first time?
Oh, no, he's shaking off the suds. Big mistake.
This son of a bitch is throwing a two-hit shutout. He's shaking me off. You believe that shit? Charlie, here comes the deuce. And when you speak of me, speak well.
No, no, serve it up.
Told him I was gonna throw a deuce, right?
Yep. Man, that ball got out of here in a hurry. You know, anything travels that far ought to have a damn stewardess on it, don't you think?
No, I think his air, his kind of cockiness that Costner has in this movie really works. Who's the X factor in this movie?
I think it's Susan Sarandon.
I think so too.
And maybe you're a little biased because she is the narrator.
Yeah.
But she, that character should not work.
No.
On paper. And that's when you're talking about all those people that auditioned for it. I can imagine they had to audition a lot of people because a small town Southern poetry spouting baseball groupie.
That's a hard role.
Who's like into like Eastern religions and stuff. It's a hard sell. And she does it perfectly. You 100% believe that she is Annie.
Yeah.
Who might be one of the most uniquely interesting people ever. And especially in a sports movie. Like, that it's such a bizarre character.
Yeah, I think just from the opening narration, you're just like, who is this person? Because it definitely has this poetic sense to it in the opening narration of it. And she's not the main character. And I think that's kind of important, is that that shows you how important she is, that even though she's not the main character and kind of not even the two person, I think you could say Nuke is the second lead in this. And well, maybe not. But she's not the person we're following.
Mm-hmm.
But yet she is the one that's telling us the story, basically. And you only hear her narration. You hear narration at the beginning when they're winning, and then the end, I believe, is when it is. No, I think she holds the film together. Like I said, if you put anyone else in that role, I don't really see it working. She was perfect for that role.
I believe in the Church of Baseball. I've tried all the major religions and most of the minor ones. I've worshipped Buddha, Allah, Brahma, Vishnu, Siva, trees, mushrooms, and Isidore Duncan. I know things. For instance, there are 108 beads in a Catholic rosary, and there are 108 stitches in a baseball. When I learned that, I gave Jesus a chance. But it just didn't work out between us. The Lord laid too much guilt on me. I prefer metaphysics to theology. You see, there's no guilt in baseball, and it's never born, which makes it like sex. There's never been a ball player slept with me who didn't have the best year of his career. Making love is like hitting a baseball. You just gotta relax and concentrate. Besides, I'd never sleep with a player hitting under 250. Well, unless he had a lot of RBIs, there was a great glove man up the middle. You see, there's a certain amount of life wisdom I give these boys. I can expand their minds. Sometimes when I've got a ball player alone, I'll just read Emily Dickinson or Walt Whitman to him. And the guys are so sweet, they always stay and listen. Of course, a guy will listen to anything if he thinks it's foreplay. I make them feel confident, and they make me feel safe and pretty. Of course, what I give them lasts a lifetime. What they give me lasts 142 games. Sometimes it seems like a bad trade. But bad trades are part of baseball. I mean, who can forget Frank Robinson for Milt Pappas, for God's sake? It's a long season, and you gotta trust it. I've tried them all, I really have. And the only church that truly feeds the soul day in, day out, is the Church of Baseball.
MVP award. Who gets the MVP award for this film?
It's Crash.
Yeah.
You turn the whole team around, man.
Well, I think Costner is the big standout. They're both big standouts.
Are we talking MVP of the movie, or are we talking MVP most valuable player or most valuable performer?
Performer.
Okay. All right. Costner for, like, actually devoting himself to playing the game.
Yeah. I think he has such a great entrance, too. Yeah. Like, when he comes in,
he's just like, why am I here?
He kind of crashes into the thing. Why am I here? Why am I taking this? Why am I being demoted to this? And like, who are you? Player to be named later. Like, he's aware of the situation. He knows what his role is, and he just sees him like he sees his role dwindling. It's like, why am I going from being AAA, where I'm so close to being in the majors, and now I'm being bumped down to single A? And then the next thing is, which couple has more chemistry? I think you kind of already answered it. It's Costner and Sarandon.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's clear throughout that Sarandon is, and she says it at some point in the narration. She says, you know, I've rarely met a baseball player who is like intellectually a match for me. She's just used to that. They're meatheads. She tries to teach them a little bit of enough spirituality and intellectualism to get them. To give them what they need in the game, but I think she says they don't stimulate me outside of the bedroom or something like that, and that, you know, that's what Crash is like, kind of created to be that her equal in that level, or at least you know, he can't quote Whitman with her, but he can, you know, understand her.
He knows who Whitman is.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like when she says, "Do you know who Walt Whitman is? Is he a player?" That's what Nuke says. Like, Nuke's completely unaware. And then when she starts reading him poetry, he's just like, "Are we gonna like have sex?"
Yeah. You're supposed to be able to understand that her experiences have been more like what is happening with Nuke than anything she's experiencing with, because she's never really come up against someone like Crash.
And that's the scene when she goes to his apartment and like they kind of have their face off, where she becomes very attracted to him in that moment, because it feels like she's probably never had one of the players go back at her in that way.
The road of excess leads to the Palace of Wisdom, William Blake.
What, William Blake?
William Blake.
What, William Blake?
William Blake.
What do you mean, William Blake?
I mean, William Blake.
Who are you? I mean, do you have a job?
I teach part-time at Alamance Junior College. English 101 and beginning composition.
You know, having a conversation with you is like is like a Martian talking to a fungo.
Oh, cute. That's really, you know, just because sometimes you manage to be clever and you have a nice smile does not mean you are not full of shit.
But I'm full of shit.
You're full of shit.
I'm full of shit.
You are full of shit.
Nuke's chastity was your idea.
I know, I'm telling you, just keep your hands out.
I never told him to stay out of your bed.
You most certainly did.
I never told him to stay out of your bed.
Yes, you did.
I told him that a player on a streak has to respect the streak.
Fine.
You know why? Because they don't happen very often.
Right.
If you believe you're playing well because you're getting laid, or because you're not getting laid, or because you wear women's underwear, then you are. And you should know that.
Questions for the movie. This is the one part that I thought was very unrealistic. Would Nuke jump straight from single A baseball to the majors?
No, I absolutely, that was the only part of the film that did not feel realistic to me.
Yeah.
He you see him getting better, but he's still not reliable whatsoever.
No.
The understanding is he's only better because the team has finally gotten some chemistry, and that's because of Crash.
I don't see him becoming a...
He's still throwing wild pitches. Like, we're still seeing cuts. He's not just sending them straight down every time. Like,
and he has a horrible game, I think. Like, they lose. He has a bad game, and he still gets caught up to the majors right after that. Also, I'm sorry if this man listens. I'm kidding. He's not. His father might be the worst actor in the movie. Like, something about his father does not work for me. It would have been better. Like, the only thing that works for me is when he's waving with the camera. When the guy actually has dialogue, and he's in a scene with Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon, he cannot hold his own in that scene. That's how I felt. It just felt like a complete, like, oh God, who's this guy? Like, could you not have casted someone a little bit more, like, not charismatic, but like...
At least with experience.
Yeah, it felt like it was a guy they cast that was based in Durham.
Probably,
And worked at his community theater, and they're like, hey, you can play Tim Robbins' dad.
Yeah.
Like, it just did, it didn't work for me.
Not to speak poorly of local casting.
No.
That can work out very well sometimes.
David Gordon Green has cast some amazing people out of South Carolina or North Carolina. Sometimes, I don't know. It just did not work. It did not work for me. What genres does this film fit under?
I mean, outside of being a sports movie, I'd call it a comedy for sure. Like, it's got an air of it still feels like it's set in the real world, but it's got an air of like comedic feel to everything. But I think it's a romance.
Yeah. I think it's definitely a rom-com. Would it fit under screwball comedy?
I don't know if there's enough interaction between the two of them.
Okay.
To really... Because
there's scenes of it.
Yeah, there's scenes with that energy, but I don't think... I think I would need more play off of them.
Okay.
To make that call. Because that's you know, what it's... The sharp dialogue is like... The calling card.
She doesn't really have that with Tim Robbins. She has that with Costner.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's not enough scene. Okay, I gotcha. Last thing, or last question. Could this be made today? And if so, who do you cast?
Yeah, I think so. I'd love to see this made today. I was just thinking, as we were talking about like wanting to build the world out a little bit more, I would love a like TV show about minor league baseball.
A limited series TV show?
Yeah, yeah, I would love that. And you can just explore how weird that world is. Okay, give me Wyatt Russell as Nuke.
Okay.
All right, here's someone who's a little bit...
I'm fine with Nuke.
What are we looking for Crash? Like 35?
I was thinking 35, yeah. What's also weird, too, is that because I was looking at 35-year-old actors, they all look so much younger than Costner. That's the one thing, is that
no,
Costner
you want, just... You, I'd say you want somebody 45 to play young 35 at this point.
Because it was I was looking at people, it was just like, the people that were like in that age range were like... Chris Pine, like Henry Cavill, like all these guys were in that range. I was like, I don't think those are Crash.
Okay. You know what? Give me Bradley Cooper as Crash.
Okay. I could see Bradley Cooper as Crash. And that's an interesting dynamic with him and Wyatt Russell.
Bradley Cooper as Crash. Ooh, Annie would be...
That's the hard one. Annie's a hard character to get.
I'm kind of tempted to say Emma Stone.
See, I thought... Okay, here's what I thought at one point. I thought Emma Stone as Anna, or Annie, and Gosling as Crash. But I don't know if Gosling can pull off Crash.
Yeah, I want someone a little more weathered. Gosling still feels a little too, like, wide-eyed and like, ready to go.
I don't know, man. I mean, you can get him with a beard, get him chiseled up. I don't know. Couple beers in him. Emma Stone was one I thought of too. Something she has that charm to her that I think Sarandon has as Annie.
Yeah, I don't want to say quirky because I feel like people take that the wrong way sometimes.
See,
but you do need to buy her as a philosophical English professor baseball fan. Like,
yeah.
And not everyone can pull that off.
And Stone might be a little too young for it. That's the only thing. I feel like someone would try to put Amy Adams in the role.
Because she did Trouble with the Curve.
Oh, God, that movie. Yes, the thing is, so like Emma Stone would be the youngest of the three people. She's 31 right now, and Bradley Cooper's 45.
Hey, they've done it before. Aloha.
Don't bring that movie up on this podcast. Don't you dare. That character's tough.
Mary Elizabeth Winstead?
I could actually buy that.
Hmm?
I could actually buy Mary Elizabeth Winstead as that. Because I think Mary Elizabeth Winstead does have the comedic timing for that role. I think Birds of Prey kind of proves that. I think she was the funniest part of that movie. Mm-hmm. Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Bradley Cooper as Crash, and Wyatt Russell as Nuke. I could buy all that.
Yeah, you'd watch that?
I'd watch that. I'd watch that.
Yeah, put them in a miniseries. I would 100%.
Okay. HBO.
In a heartbeat.
In a heartbeat. Well, any other things to say about Bull Durham? I'm glad you enjoyed it. I was actually kind of worried. I was like, he's going to hate this movie.
No, this is what, if Kevin Costner's career looked more like this, I would have a higher opinion of him.
You found a way to make it a backhanded compliment. I love that. If he was ever this good again, he'd have a good career.
I mean, he's good in Field of Dreams. He is a very grounded, likable everyman. Yeah. But not one that translates well. Some people are, like Harrison Ford, is grounded in a way that makes you enjoy seeing him put in all these crazy situations.
Yes.
Kevin Costner is grounded in a way that just, when he's in all these crazy situations, it just makes me feel how out of place he is. And that's not a dig on him. Everyone has their strengths. Everyone has their weaknesses. It is foolish to think that just because someone is a good actor means they can play any role. That is not true.
I agree with that.
You cannot. Daniel Day-Lewis could not be Crash Davis.
Nope.
But so, you know, sometimes and I guess this comes from like having, you know, a little bit more of a background in casting, but like sometimes I'll say like so-and-so like couldn't play that role, and they're like, well, they're a great actor. I'm like, that's
not what I'm saying. Yeah.
Just because you're a great actor doesn't mean you can become anything. And he is very good at this.
Yeah,
is what Kevin Costner is very good at.
Yeah, I feel like every person has the ability to, like, every actor has the ability to pull off one great role. The question is finding that great role for them and that niche. It's like, well, this is a different thing, but like a casting story I remember hearing, a movie called The Goodbye Girl with Richard Dreyfuss, and that was written by Neil Simon. And originally they cast Robert De Niro for the Richard Dreyfuss character. And De Niro, it can be really funny, but his comedy style is very different than Richard Dreyfuss's comedy style. Dreyfuss has this manic, like...
You always get the feeling that Richard Dreyfuss is over his head, or at least that's when he works best. And even when De Niro is playing comedy, it still feels like he's in control of the situation.
Yeah, De Niro's comedy feels very human. Like, he's finding the comedy in real life, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, here's a perfect thing. De Niro and Scorsese, one of the greatest pairings of all time, actor and director, would not put De Niro in After Hours. Because...
Not at all.
De Niro would never feel... De Niro could never pull off that feeling of being pushed and pulled and manipulated the way that...
No,
that character is
not at all, and that's how I feel with him. And Goodbye Girl is that he just feels like he could not get the he doesn't seem like the actor who like is trying to play Richard III on off Broadway and trying to make it funny.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think De Niro's biggest comedy role, like it or not, is Meet the Parents,
and
the joke in Meet the Parents is taking the De Niro persona, which is a guy who has his fingers in everything and is always pulling the strings, and putting him in a setting where he shouldn't be like that.
I think even Analyze This and Analyze That, that series is a similar thing where it's playing off you have to play off his persona to get the comedy. It's a similar thing with Brando. They did that with a movie called The Freshman with Matthew Broderick. Check it out. It's actually pretty good. But Brando's basically playing like a Vito Corleone character, but it's a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to do that. So anyway, we can go on about actors on a different episode. We'll do that all the time. I'm just trying to
make sure, Kevin Costner, if you're bored during quarantine and you're listening to our podcast for any reason, I am not saying you're a bad actor. I'm just saying that you have been cast poorly in a few things and cast yourself poorly in a few things.
But you nailed this perfectly.
You nailed Crash Davis. Thank you for that.
That's what you gave us. Anyway, maybe we'll do more episodes like this with sports films. We'll have to figure out which one we should do. I really want to do Bull Durham because Thomas hasn't seen it. And I feel like it's a baseball film because I know he loves minor league baseball. He should have watched. So we'll see what we do next time. If it's a genre or if it's a movie or if it's a director. Could be in a week. Could be in 2 weeks. We're not sure yet at this point.
Who knows anything at this
point? Who knows anything? We have the time. But we hope you're staying safe. You're staying inside, social distancing, washing your hands. Yeah. Make sure you follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Give us a rating. Give us a review. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Check out our Medium. I'm starting to post more articles or trying to post more articles of late during this time because I have time to actually write finally. Just posted one recently of the Truman Show that you can check out on Medium. So, yeah. Thomas, anything else?
Everybody, you know, watch some good stuff.
Watch good stuff and wash your hands.
Yeah, don't fall prey to just watching whatever's popping up on Netflix. Go seek it out. There's a lot of great content out there.
So many streaming services right now are doing free trials for like weeks or months. Shudder's doing one for a month and all that. CBS doing it for a month. Mubi, I don't know if it still is. They're doing one where it's pay a dollar and you get 3 months for Mubi.com. They give you a movie a day that you can check out. Guys, thank you so much for listening. Thomas, as always, thank you so much for coming on the show. And we hope you guys listen to more episodes soon. Bye.